Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The topic of tonight's talk is, does God care about suffering, the death of Socrates versus the death of Christ? And thank you, all of you, for your patience with my flight delay. Of course, the Latin word patience comes from the same word as the word for suffering, so thank you for your suffering. As a quick note, if anyone is listening to this recording, there are two paintings that I'm going to talk about later that I'd be referencing. The Death of Socrates by Jacques-Louis David from 1787, and the Eisenheim altarpiece painted by Matthias Grunewald in 1516. If anyone doesn't have those images, I think there are handouts in the back. But anyway, if anyone's listening to this recording, as I have sometimes had the experience of doing, I'm speaking here to the microphone, those are the two paintings that I'm going to talk about. Okay. Let's begin. St. John Chrysostom says, "No event is so sublime as this. The blood of God has been poured out for us. It is more than our adoption as children, more than any other thing, that God did not spare his only son. This is by far the greatest thing." This talk is about two deaths and how they help us to think about the great problem of suffering. Let's start with the first death, that of Socrates. When I was 18 years old, I had an experience that has been happening for over 2,000 years. I fell in love with Socrates. I was enraptured by Socrates' call to discuss virtue every day, as he says in his apology. For I had a hunger to discuss and find and live the good life in a world that doesn't care as much about it. I heard his call to give consideration to the best possible state of your soul, as he says also in his apology, as the most ennobling and invigorating invitation I had ever received. Maybe some of you in this room, freshmen or sophomores, have had the same experience if you've encountered Socrates. And if you haven't, I urge you to read his apology, the defense speech he gave at his trial in the days before he died. I was so taken with Socrates that when I was a freshman in college, I even made an effort to memorize the apology, though admittedly I never got past the second page. Still, when I read its introduction, it floods back to me. I was even for a time a bit of an evangelist for the love of Socrates. And I remember with a tinge of cringe, after my freshman year, trying to entice my younger brother into the love of Socrates by a formal reading group, just the two of us, brothers, on summer break. You know, just two teenage guys in the summer reading about Socrates. It's to his credit that he didn't mock me, but you are welcome to laugh at me. That's fine. If you know anything, though, about the work of Plato, you'll know that this experience of falling in love with philosophy by becoming enamored with Socrates is simply an echo of what happened to many young men of Athens. In fact, it's an echo of what happened to Plato himself, who wrote Socrates' apology, his speech that he gave when he was sentenced to death, and his Phaedo, which we'll be looking at today, the story of his death and the final hours of his life. To understand the appeal of Socrates, though, you have to think both about the courage with which he lived and the courage with which he died. Because even if today he might attract the intellectuals, the nerds, if you will, in his day, some of the richest and most ambitious young men of Athens were captivated by him. Why is that? I don't think it's just the intellectual. I think it's because he had the courage to live the way he thought, and this made him fearless. Now, Socrates may be out of fashion today, but courage never is. No one becomes a man without courage. But Socrates, who served in the Athenian army as a young man, had the courage to think and the courage to live the way he thought. And this courage is contagious, and it led to his death. Of course, there is no greater test of courage than the prospect of death. And there's no greater sign of courage than being willing to die when it's right. Why was Socrates killed by the city of Athens in the year 339 BC? He was charged and convicted with two crimes. The first was introducing strange divinities, and the second was corrupting the young. These two charges are, in a way, just one charge, since it is precisely by introducing strange divinities that he was thought to have corrupted the young. This was the charge made against him. And he was, at least, in Plato's dialogues at least, a relentless critic of the stories that people would tell about the gods, the stories that you could find in the poets, especially Homer. And because of this, he's accused of introducing strange divinities in place of the gods of the city. And thus, in a way, you could say that Socrates is charged with blasphemy. Even in a way, he's accused of atheism. But note that Socrates is not a critic. When I say this, I don't mean that Socrates is a critic of the gods or even a critic of the god, which Socrates frequently talks about. He's a critic of the lies of the poets about the gods, which presupposes that there is, conversely, a truth about the gods, even a poetic truth. And this Socrates ardently believed in and desired to know. So Socrates was not an atheist who turned from superstition. Socrates wanted to purify religion from superstition, and through this purification is exactly what led to his death. For a taste of the courage of Socrates, this is what he says when the jurors convicted him and were deliberating over his proper punishment. This is a quotation from his apology. "Men of Athens," he says, "I am grateful and I am your friend, but I will obey God rather than you. And as long as I draw breath and am able, I shall not cease to practice philosophy," which of course simply means the love of wisdom, "and to exhort you. After all, are you not ashamed of your eagerness to possess as much wealth, reputation, and honors as possible, while you do not care for nor give thought to wisdom or truth or the best possible state of your soul?" These sound like the kinds of things that Christians often say today. Is it any surprise in reading words like this that Socrates would be the best and most admirable of philosophers? The story of Socrates' fate became undoubtedly the most memorable account of anyone's death in antiquity, with one exception, which is the death of Jesus. Before we turn to the two of them, it's worth noting the number of parallels between these two famous deaths, which I'm going to talk about a little bit more specifically, because these parallels are uncanny. Both men attracted a wide range of followers who later wrote copious amounts about their teaching. Plato wrote about Socrates, while the gospel writers and other early Christians wrote about Christ. But famously, neither Christ nor Socrates ever wrote anything down themselves. Both provoked the ire of those in authority because they seemed to turn the world upside down and drew attention to many different vices: the shame of hypocrisy, the lust of honor, the neglect of wisdom, the love of riches, as I just mentioned, in quoting from the Apology. In fact, both Jesus and Socrates are characteristically depicted asking questions, provocative, destabilizing questions. No one could withstand Socrates' questioning. This is a famous aspect of all the Platonic dialogues, just like no one could withstand the questions of Christ in the Gospels. The uncanny similarities are especially clear when we get to their deaths. Both Socrates and Jesus were put to death in rigged trials on a fundamental charge of blasphemy. Both of them had their words twisted to make this charge land, and both, in different ways, refused any legal representation and seemed to accept a certain inevitability, a fate even, a predetermination or a preordination in their death. Both died by drinking from a cup, at least of sorts, and both did so willingly. Socrates literally drinks from a cup of poisonous hemlock, which he holds in his own hands. He wants to take it in his own hands, and he drinks it himself. While Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, asked the Father to remove this cup from me, the cup of the new covenant in his blood, and nevertheless willingly embraced his cup as the Father's will become his own. And both deaths were forever memorialized in extended narratives by their disciples of their final days and hours, Christ, of course, by the four evangelists in their Gospels, and Socrates, as I've already said, by Plato in his Phaedo. Now, both texts, the Gospels and the Phaedo, use extraordinary classical allusions as well. They're filled with different allusions to highlight the character, the drama of these deaths. Plato does something subtle and on purpose when he tells the story of Socrates' death. He likens Socrates to the Greek hero Theseus. You might know Theseus in the Minotaur, this sort of famous Greek story. When Theseus was just a boy, he was part of a group of 14 children who were chosen to be the annual sacrifice that the city of Athens had to send to Crete, where they were doomed to be consumed by the Minotaur. Okay, but in the story, Theseus there slays the Minotaur, this monster, escapes from the labyrinth, and frees the other 14 children, or the 14 children, he's one of the 14. Now, ever since, in the city of Athens, they celebrated this story by sending a special ceremonial ship to and from Crete every year, and it was a law that while the ship was on its voyage, no public execution, no legal execution was permitted. So how does Plato's Phaedo make Socrates out to be a new Theseus, a hero of Athens? It's because Socrates dies on the very same day this ship returns, and he's surrounded, by Plato's counting, by precisely 14 students, 14 disciples, which suggests that the Minotaur he slays, a monster that terrifies everyone, is the fear of death. Now, the Gospels, too, as you likely all know, are filled with an almost infinite or endless number of allusions to the stories of Israel. Jesus is portrayed as the Passover lamb, slaughtered at the same hour the priests make the Passover sacrifice in the temple. And his blood covers the people so that the worst plague, death, can pass over them. Jesus is the new Isaac. Like Isaac, he's led up the mountain by his father, and he carries the wood of his own sacrifice. Okay. Jesus is the scapegoat of Leviticus, the one who has to die outside of the camp, outside of the city of Jerusalem. But the scapegoat that takes away the sins of the people, which are impossible to take away in any other way. And on one could go. Okay, why do I stress this, these classical allusions? It's not just because I think they're interesting. It's because before we can turn to the death of the gospel, to the Gospels and the death of Socrates and the Phaedo, we have to appreciate that these works are written to teach us something. Okay, they're written artfully and on purpose. They're meditations on death and suffering on purpose. That's why the allusions are there. They aren't just reports of a kind of legal tragedy. Plato wants you to fall in love with Socrates in his death, as the evangelists want you to fall in love with Christ in his death. They are profound expressions of love, both accounts, for Christ in the one and Socrates in the other, which are meant to say something fundamental about how we relate to the greatest of all suffering, death and its fear. Okay, so with that as a kind of preface, let's turn to the Phaedo. So I've given you some passages from the Phaedo, but you can find these same passages online. The Phaedo, again, the dialogue, it's a conversation, starts as a dialogue between two characters. The one is Phaedo, who was present at the death of Socrates, and the other is his friend, Echecrates, who sadly was not there. And the dialogue continues until we get to the death of Socrates. And the first words at the start of the dialogue, this would be on, I think it's page 50 on the handout, on the left side. The first words are Echecrates. So Echecrates, were you with Socrates yourself, Phaedo, on the day when he drank the poison in prison, or did someone else tell you about it? Phaedo says, Phaedo says, I was there myself, Echecrates. Echecrates says, what are the things he said before he died, and how did he die? I should be glad to hear this. All I've heard, of course, he says, is that he drank the poison and died, but nothing more. Were you there, Phaedo? You know, listen to these words. Would you tell me what he said? See how they loved him. If you've ever heard the spiritual, were you there when they crucified my Lord, you might know what the stirring in the soul is like of Echecrates' question. Were you there, Phaedo? Were you with Socrates? Now, of course, it's different, but hear the passion and the burning of what this question implies. It implies, oh, if only I could have been there myself. And this is, of course, why I want you, why he wants Phaedo, who was there, to tell him exactly what it was like, so that he could be as close as possible to being there by hearing. Okay, equally as heartfelt, then, is Phaedo's acceptance a few lines further on his happy pleasure to tell the story. Echecrates says in the next page, "Please be good enough to tell us all that occurred as fully as possible, unless you have some pressing business." And Phaedo says, "I have the time and I will try to tell you the whole story, for nothing gives me more pleasure than to call Socrates to mind, whether talking about him myself or listening to someone else do so." And Echecrates says, "Your hearers," which of course, if you think about the text, means all of you now who are listening to this story, who are about to listen to this story. "Your hearers will surely be like you in this, that is filled with pleasure in this story, to hear the story of Socrates. So do try to tell us every detail exactly as you can." And Phaedo says, "I certainly found being there an astonishing experience. Although I was witnessing the death of one who was my friend, I had no feeling of pity, for the man appeared happy in both manner and words as he died nobly and without fear, Echecrates, so that it struck me that even in going down to the underworld, he was going with the gods' blessing, and that he would fare well when he got there, if anyone ever does." So you see how Phaedo loves to recount what happened, the noble, fearless, and happy death of Socrates. And you too are invited to be like Echecrates, longing and loving to call Socrates to mind. So Phaedo then recounts all the people who were there at the trial, and then he turns to the main story. He says that he used to visit Socrates every day in prison. And then he turns to the last day and says, "After a short time, the gatekeeper came and told us to go in." Okay, this is now we're getting to the story, the last day of Socrates' life. "We found Socrates recently released from his chains. And Xanthippe, you know her." Now, of course, it's sort of funny to say, Xanthippe is Socrates' wife. We as the audience actually don't know Xanthippe. You know her, sitting by him holding their baby. "When she saw us, she cried out and said the sort of thing that women usually say. 'Socrates, this is the last time your friends will talk to you, and you to them.' Socrates looked at Crito. He said, 'Crito,' he said, 'let someone take her home.' And some of Crito's people led her away, lamenting and beating her breast." This passage is a true foretaste of what's to come. Phaedo and friends enter the room, and they find Socrates, his wife, and his child, with Xanthippe and Tyr, Socrates' wife. And Xanthippe plucks at Socrates' heart. "This is the last time you or your friends will see or speak to you. Last time you or your friends will see or speak to you," speaking to Socrates. But Socrates is unmoved. He's actually kind of sexist. Indeed, this kind of passion, the compassion that Xanthippe shows, can have no place in the scene. And so Socrates turns to Crito and says, "Take her away." If this action to casually dismiss his family at the hour of his death, itself a symbol or even an allegory of the dismissal of sorrow from death, strikes you as strange, it's already a sign, I think, of how different our way of thinking is. It's already a sign, I think, of how we've been influenced by the story of the other death. Instead, what follows after this scene is a dialogue that goes over 50 pages of why the wise man is not afraid at all of death, because he knows that the soul is immortal. Okay. Finally, with Socrates insisting that it would be shameful to keep clinging to any more seconds of life, he's brought the cup of poison by the executioner. He receives the cup quite cheerfully and only asks if he can take a moment to offer a prayer to the gods, which he does. And then he says, and this is at the end of the dialogue, so now we're going to look at the last two pages. "While Socrates was saying this, he was holding the cup and then drained it calmly and easily. Most of us had been able to hold back our tears reasonably well up till then. But when we saw him drinking it and after he drank it, we could hold them back no longer. My own tears," this is Phaedo still speaking, "came in floods against my will. So I covered my face. I was weeping for myself, not for him, for my misfortune in being deprived of such a comrade. Even before me, Crito was unable to restrain his tears and got up. Apollodorus," another friend who was there, "had not ceased from weeping before, and at this moment his noisy tears and anger made everybody present break down, except for Socrates." Now, at this point, I want to pause for a moment and ask you to look at the first of the two paintings that I provided. This is the death of Socrates, okay? So in the middle, you can see there is Socrates. He's sitting there with his hand raised, pointing up, up to the sky above. And see how the artist has depicted this scene, okay? I think it's a perfect illustration of what we were just reading in the Phaedo. This scene, the death of Socrates. See how noble he is, so composed. Everyone around Socrates is in tears. They've turned their faces away. They're weeping. You can even see at the bottom, there are chains on the floor. All right, there are chains on the floor, not on Socrates' body, as a sign that Socrates is free. And he has his finger stretched up to heaven. He doesn't even look at the cup that he's being offered. He doesn't need to. You see Socrates' full chest exposed as this sort of sign of his self-control and composure. And I think this is exactly what the Phaedo is giving us, an image of Socrates utterly unmoved by his death, even in contrast to everyone around him. Okay, so with this, keep this image in mind. Let's look at what Socrates says to go back to the Phaedo. Just after the passage I was just reading from, that ended, except Socrates. This is what Socrates says. "What is this?" he said. "You strange fellows. It is mainly for this reason that I sent the women away." There's that sexism again. "To avoid such unseemliness, for I am told one should die in good omened silence. So keep quiet and control yourselves." His words made us ashamed, and we checked our tears. After this, the poison begins to take effect. Socrates lies down, his body growing cold, and he gives his final words. You can see this on the last page of the text, in that short section. "Crito, we owe us a cock to Asclepius. Make this offering to him and do not forget." What do these words mean? Well, Asclepius is the Greek god of healing. Socrates wants to offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving, a sacrificing gratitude of a cock, a rooster, for the healing that Asclepius has given him, which is, of course, the healing that comes by being liberated by death. And the dialogue ends with these words of Phaedo. "Such was the end of our comrade Echecrates, a man who, we would say, was of all those we have known the best and also the wisest and the most upright." How different to you now might appear the depiction of the death of Christ. On this, the Gospels of Mark and Matthew are basically the same. And I want to, I imagine you're familiar with these passages, but I want to turn now to what the Gospels say. I haven't provided this because I assume that the Phaedo was new to everyone, but the Gospels maybe ring a bell, at least. Here's what Mark says, and I've added a little bit of Matthew. This is how Christ dies. "And they went to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I pray.' And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled." Matthew says, in place of Mark, "sorrowful and troubled." "And Jesus said to them, 'My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch.' And going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, 'Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will.' And he came and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, 'Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.'" In Matthew, Christ says, "Sleep and take your rest later on, so the hour is at hand and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners." And both Gospels say that he went and prayed again. And then in Mark, as well as in Matthew, the last words of Christ are the ones that he utters on the cross, those famous words. This is what Mark says. "And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani,' which means, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" Luke, I think, gives something very similar. The last words of Christ are different in Luke. The scene in the garden is different. But Luke, but the overall structure is the same. Luke even adds this line, "And being in agony," this is while Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, "and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground." Now, I want you to think for a moment. If you live in the first century, and the most famous account of anyone's death is the death of Socrates, you could reasonably ask yourself, why would the gospel writers possibly depict Jesus dying in this way? The contrast with Socrates, it seems to me, could not be more stark. Jesus not only dies, but he dies in agony. We as modern readers often imagine death by crucifixion in terms of pain. The crucifixion is pain, the pain of the nails, if nails were used, and especially the pain of suffocation. But in the ancient world, crucifixion was less a sign of pain than a sign of shame, which is, of course, its own excruciatingly intense pain. Crucifixion in the Roman world is the death of the worst possible human beings. The Apostle Paul, you might remember, is not crucified. He's beheaded. Why is that? It's because Paul is a Roman citizen, and this, the Romans think, is a more noble way to die. This is how a citizen should die. It's when the Romans determine, crucifixion, by contrast, in the Roman imagination, is the most humiliating possible way to die. It's what the Romans do when they want to dominate someone, to show them that they have lost and that they should know it. It's the death in the Roman world for slaves, who are lifted up for all to see, with their death drawn out, less to lengthen the pain of dying and more to lengthen the pain of shame. And yet Jesus' embrace of the shame of crucifixion extends even to his embrace of the shame of suffering. Jesus' soul is sorrowful even unto death. Whereas Socrates says that one should die in good omen silence, Jesus cries out to God, "Why have you forsaken me?" The gratuitousness of the pain, the suffering, the agony, is reflected really well in the artistic tradition. And that's why I've given you the second image that I want to pause for a moment and think about. This, as I mentioned, is Grunewald's Eisenheim altarpiece. This is in France today. I think this is one of the most striking and famous images of Jesus' crucifixion. Perhaps many of you have seen it before. Look for a moment at how the artistic depiction of Jesus' death matches the language of the Gospels, drawing attention to the extent of his sorrow and suffering and agony. You can see Jesus' face is contorted, but also his whole body is covered in sores and in thorns. His wounds, of course, the monastery that this altarpiece is in was a hospital for the sick, especially those who were suffering from plague and skin diseases. And so the monks would have immediately recognized in this image of Jesus, signs of someone suffering from plague. You can see how the wounds of Christ reflect the worst possible bodily suffering that someone can endure. Even look at Christ's hands, how the artist has depicted them as twisted. You can see Christ's eyes are open, his mouth hangs open, his mouth hangs open in pain, but in the exhaustion of pain, you might say. His face is contrasted, is not contrasted with, but actually is perfectly reflected in the faces of John and Mary, which are overcome with grief. Perhaps the most well-known part of this image is the finger of John the Baptist pointing at Christ. The finger of John the Baptist that has this ever so slight bend in it, this crookedness to it, as if to draw your attention even more to how extreme the suffering of Christ is. And you can see very faintly written right next to John the Baptist's finger are these Latin words, "Illim oportet crescere meam autem minui." This is Latin for, "I must increase, but he must decrease." As if to say that John the Baptist, pointing to the crucifixion, is asking, is this what his increase really looks like? This is the Lamb of God? Having looked at these two images, having given you a clear sense of the contrast, I want to consider now what these deaths say about suffering. How are you supposed to suffer? What are you supposed to think about the evils that befall us? What sense can we make of suffering? And what should our response be? I want to consider four possible answers, how they account for these two stories, and also what these stories might say to us in turn. The first one. A first response to suffering is to think that we must learn to accept that for finite creatures like us, There is actually no knowable explanation of evil, precisely because the things that we have in view, God and evil, with us in consideration, are utterly incomparable. After all, who are you to raise the question? Who am I to know what the meaning or purpose of my suffering is? We must stress, and I think this is crucial, that when we raise this kind of question, how could God allow suffering? We must stress and never cease stressing that God is not some being among other beings. God is not an agent in the world. It doesn't matter how big you think the world is or how big you think God is. God is not one simply like us, one among us. This is what the prophet Isaiah says. Did you think that I was one like you? He's not an actor on the stage of world history, making his choices like we make ours and accountable to the same standards. It must be equally insisted, though, that Christians do not say this out of some special pleading about God, as if we were trying to absolve God of evil by declaring him above the law. We're simply trying to keep in mind that God is not above the law, he is the law. And if that's the case, if God is truly the source of everything, okay, not some agent in the world like you and me who makes determinations about what's right and wrong, good and evil, based on our knowledge of some higher standard, but if he is the standard, if he really is the ultimate source and substance of all goodness, then the objection that God and suffering are incompatible could have a kind of moral force, maybe, but never a logical force. Because unless you possess a divine, eternal, and ultimate perspective on every single fact of creation, on every relationship between creatures and God, unless you yourself are God and have the perspective of God, then you simply can't understand God's ultimate understanding of evil. There's a kind of, I'm trying to name a perspective that you might have in the midst of suffering. And there's strong biblical precedent for thinking something like this in God's response to Job, which I won't go into at much length other than simply to quote the response of God. Okay, in order to give us some substance to this perspective, that perhaps when it comes to our suffering, we have to accept some kind of a kind of mystery, something that we can't understand, that we can't fathom. In Job, God appears without any warning in chapter 38. He gives a final and unexpected reply to Job's sufferings. And this is what he says. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you will make it known to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements?" On and on, God continues with questions like this. He continues, "Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb and said, 'Thus far shall you come and no further, and here shall your proud waves be stayed'? Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all of this." And of course, in humility, all of us who hear this are supposed to answer, "I don't know. I do not comprehend the expanse of the earth. The gates of death have not been revealed to me. I was not there when God laid the foundations of the world." I think we must take this response seriously, even if we have an inclination to protest against it. Because at minimum, if we did have a divine perspective, we could think to ourselves, isn't it at least possible that we would learn something about suffering or about evil that would alleviate our concern? Can we really know? If it is at least possible that God sees rightly, isn't some silence justified? Now, in many ways, acceptance of a mystery to suffering, something unknowable about suffering, and learning to live with this, looks a lot like the approach of Socrates. Or at least you might think that if you accepted that evil was an unknowable mystery, and that you as a human being in all humility needed to accept this, to understand this, then you might think that Socrates was vindicated, and that the best way to suffer would be, as Socrates says, in good omen silence. Since you have accepted, fully accepted, that you cannot understand suffering and evil. After all, Job complains, and God rebukes him. And yet, even though Socrates does provide a model of profound acceptance of suffering without complaint, that is not all he does. Socrates also thinks that death isn't even an evil at all. The only evil, Socrates thinks, is in the soul. And since Socrates has done nothing wrong, there is nothing bad to fear or feel sorry for. But I think that most of us sense that if the price of Socrates' peace, even his peace and humility, is the conviction that death is not an evil at all, then the price is actually too great to bear. I think if we think about the scene that we've just considered, we find ourselves naturally with Socrates' wife and his friends. His death is an evil. Even if it's not an evil for him, it is an evil for us. Why? Because we are separated unwillingly from him by death. It's an evil for us because we love him. And it should be an evil for him if he loves us, because he is separated from us as well. And if that's true, then the only person for whom death cannot be an evil at all is a person who loves no one. And that, I think, is hardly admirable. And so we have to say more. So you might think, secondly, a second approach that you might have to your suffering. You might think that there's a reason for your suffering, that there is something you can understand about it. You can say, this is a reason, and that it's due to your sins. And in fact, that overall, your suffering is bitter but healing medicine. And here, in considering this perspective, you're imagining now, if you recall the story of Job, like the friends of Job. Now, I would like to argue that this cannot be the whole answer, but before I do so, I must insist that it is in some way a true answer. However out of fashion it may seem, the existence of suffering in the Christian tradition is only rendered intelligible in light of the world's fall into sin. Christians are absolutely committed to the belief that suffering cannot exist in a world without sin. The doctrine of original sin, as unpopular as it is a conclusion that holds three fundamental truths: that God is himself wholly good, and therefore he is not the source of evil. In short, God is not an evil God. That the created world is itself as made by God good, and therefore its nature is not the source of evil. In short, evil does not come from a defect in the natural world. And third, that human nature is itself as made by God good, and therefore human nature is not the source of evil. If you hold these three things, God is not evil, the created world is not evil, and human nature as made by God is not evil, and nonetheless recognize that evil does exist, then the Christian doctrine of the fall holds that evil's existence doesn't come from one of these things, but holds instead that evil was introduced into the world by the choices of fallen creatures. And over again, the stories of Scripture testify to a truth that the Apostle Paul sums up very succinctly when he says that the wages of sin is death. Sin is easy to deny, but no one can deny death. Death and all its suffering is the undeniable sign of our having fallen in sin. And so this explanation for the evil of suffering in the world, especially death, that suffering is God's just response to human sin, is undeniable for Christians. Indeed, in this light, Christians are actually able to point to many goods that can come from suffering, precisely because it is not merely a punishment for our fall, but enlisted in our suffering. In other words, Christians can say that suffering can have a restorative or remedial dimension to it. This is what C.S. Lewis argues in his Problem of Pain, that suffering, though intrinsically bad, is wisely used by God to provoke and enable our return to him. And he gives three reasons. Suffering shatters our illusion that we are morally innocent. Suffering recalls us from complacent satisfaction with the world to seek the imperishable good that God alone has. And suffering is a sign of true self-denial, since true self-denial is always painful for people who love themselves too much. And so the way Lewis puts it rather succinctly is, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our consciences, but shouts in our pain. Pain is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Hence, suffering is a companion to our contrition, leading us to sorrow for sins for the sake of the joy of knowing God. Now, in all three cases, Lewis is very clear to note that the help that suffering can give in the return to God must fall under a conviction of divine justice. Suffering is geared towards our moral improvement and provides a good example for others, but it is also, Lewis thinks, a fitting due, a penalty, yes, even a punishment to sin. And I know we're uncomfortable with that language, but Lewis explains that as appealing as it is in the modern world to think of punishment solely as a deterrence or solely for the sake of moral reform, He points out that any punishment that is given merely as a deterrence or merely for the sake of moral reform is a horrendous offense against justice. If I stood here, for example, and said that it's good for us to be deterred from theft, you might all agree. But if I then select one of you at random to be jailed as a sign to deter the rest of you from theft, I would accomplish deterrence just as well, but I think you would rightly think what I was doing was absurd and unjust. Or if I say that I reject any sense in which punishment is retributed, that it can't be owed or deserved or due, that it's only for the sake of moral reform, you might all agree and think moral reform is a good thing. But if I were then dish out jail time, not as if you deserve it, but just for the sake of your moral reform, we would quickly realize that penalties and punishments only make sense if we have some inclination of justice, if there's some proportion between offense and penalty. Punishment is only just if it is in some sense owed, if I am the one who has done wrong. So does sin provide a sufficient answer to my suffering, and by extension also to the suffering of others? If it did, perhaps we should adopt a more stoic attitude to our suffering, that our attitude should be that all suffering, at least anything worthy of the name, is actually a just consequence for evil, and that the sufferings of others is due to the same. Don't complain. It's simply what we deserve. It's a fact. It's just the medicine we need. What might be difficult here? One problem with this response to our suffering, however, is that the same scripture that tells us that our suffering is due to sin, also knows that this truth can never provide a perfect account of all the suffering in the world. Why is that? Because although sin might explain why we suffer, it can't explain why people suffer so differently, why some people suffer more and others suffer less. It cannot explain the particularities of your suffering. All too often, the unjust prosper and the just are afflicted with pain. In one place, people suffer horrifically, and another, they live in tranquility. Jesus himself says in Luke 13, there were some present at that day, recounting first the passage, there were some present at that day who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered them in response, "Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered in this way? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. Or those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them, do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others who lived in Jerusalem? No, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." Now, we don't know what events Jesus is referring to exactly, but his point is clear. Those people who suffered and were killed were not worse sinners. Their punishment was not a one-to-one correspondence to their sins. It was not because of their sins that they suffered in this way. Now, Jesus does not deny that suffering comes to sinners. He says, unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. But suffering is due to sin in general. He does deny that we can perform a kind of calculation, a one-to-one, where you can match suffering to sin, that this suffering would be due to that sin. This we can't do. This is not the way that suffering works. Those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell, they were not more guilty or worse offenders than the others. And this is, of course, manifest above all else in the suffering of Christ himself, who suffers despite having and knowing no sin at all. So the truth that suffering is caused by sin can't exhaustively explain suffering, and it can't yet explain the tears of Christ. So we come to a third way you might view your suffering, which is also true and even more important than the other two views. You might understand your suffering in this sense, that God has a reason for it, because he can work some greater good from it. We find a perfect example of this in the story of Joseph at the end of Genesis. Remember that Joseph is betrayed by his 11 brothers, nearly killed and thrown into slavery. How could this happen to Joseph? After Joseph is later restored to his brothers, they come to him seeking forgiveness. And Joseph says in response, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." So Joseph is very clear. God did not will evil against Joseph. But God did allow the evil of his brothers. And while they acted against Joseph with an evil intention, which was to ruin him, God allowed their actions and worked even greater good out of it, which was the salvation of many people, including Joseph's own wicked brothers. And this is a pattern for all the ways in which God permits some evil suffering in order to effect some unique good. Even in the case of Jesus, the New Testament says that he was made perfect through suffering. This is a consoling thought, I think, in a way. And in a way, it's kind of like the thought of Socrates. Perhaps this thing that is happening to me is actually a way to something good, which is better, like coming into the afterlife by dying. Now, Socrates doesn't know this for certain. He might know that his soul is immortal, but he doesn't know what will come of it. For Christians, of course, we can be immeasurably more confident that God works the good of eternal joy after a life of suffering, because we have the assurance and the example of Christ himself. The letter to the Hebrews says that Christ, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame. He endured the cross for joy. And so Christians confidently know that their suffering is not the last word, and that we are thus not defeated by suffering or deprived of joy. In fact, in considering that our suffering is a momentary affliction before eternal life, we can say with Paul, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us." In comparison with our future good, what is our suffering worth sorrowing for? And yet it seems to me, as true as this answer is, they are still the tears of Christ in the garden. What is the meaning of those tears? He knows there is joy set before him. Why then does he weep? Why not be like Socrates, dying in good omen silence, confident that joy is just around the corner? Why wouldn't this be how we respond to our suffering? I think the tears of Christ call us out of a temptation we can fall into, which is the error of thinking that just because God can work good from the evil I suffer, that doesn't mean that the evil I suffer is not actually a bad thing. That doesn't make the evil a good thing. The knowledge that God can and does work good after and even through suffering does not mean that God turns evil into a good. To say that he makes good out of evil is not the same thing as saying that he makes evil be good. And all too often, this is what we secretly crave. We ask what the reason for some suffering is. Why did this happen? Why did this happen to him? We ask what the reason for some suffering or evil is, because deep down, we want someone to show us that we were mistaken, that there's really no evil at all, just good, just everything good. And the reason for this is because if you could show me a good reason for the bad that happened to me, an exhaustive reason, a perfectly good reason, then it wouldn't actually be evil anymore. It would be perfectly justified. It would be a good. We want to hear that the evils we've experienced are actually just goods in disguise and we haven't seen it yet. And I think this seems to be the absurdity that Socrates falls into. He not only thinks that good might come, which may be true, but he has to deny that there is even evil in dying, though it is obvious to all his friends who weep for him. But Christ weeps at his death, even though he knows that joy is set before him. And in doing so, he shows us that death really is an evil. It's a tragedy when children die, even if they go to heaven. It's a horror when we're tormented, even if it makes us holier. We cannot deny this. Good may come from it, but that does not make evil a good in disguise. And the knowledge that God works good out of evil does not make our suffering an illusion. Our suffering remains suffering. And so if this is the case, I think we can come to a fourth point. The death of Christ teaches us a final truth, not as a replacement to the other truths, and not even as a replacement to the nobility of Socrates, but as a truth transcending and completing them. Because for Christians, this suffering of Christ is the suffering of the Son of God become man. And it shows us that in addition to the three things we've already seen, three things we can say about our suffering, that suffering is in some way a mystery, that it is due to sin, though not in every sense, and that God works good out of suffering, without suffering being good. But we as Christians can know one more consoling truth in our suffering. And it's in order to help you to think about this truth that I've gone through this whole exercise of comparing the deaths of Christ and Socrates. We as Christians can know one more consoling truth in our suffering. which is that because of his agony, Christ knows our suffering even when no one else does. God's ultimate response to the evil of the world is not to sweep it away as if it ever never happened. There is no delete key on history. His response to evil is to become one of us in the worst possible suffering. This is, of course, the literal meaning of compassion. To have compassion is to co-suffer, co-passion, to suffer with. As Hebrews says, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. This, I think, is our final consolation. We call to mind the sorrow and agony of Christ, that he knows every weakness and temptation we have undergone. We are fully known, and we are not alone, even in suffering. And God has given us the greatest possible truth that he truly cares about our suffering by undergoing it in himself. Because all of us, whether it has happened to you yet in life or not, will face deep suffering. The suffering of untimely deaths, of wounds that don't heal, of unforgiven or unrepented wrongs, of decisions other people make for you that you did not want. And suffering cannot be altogether avoided, but it can be endured. And there is no consolation for enduring suffering as profound as the compassion of Christ, the presence with us in suffering. And I think this is because perhaps one of the most painful dimensions of suffering is just how lonely it makes us feel. When we suffer, the world seems to continue in cold indifference to our suffering. No one else seems to know our pain. When you have a deep pain within you and everything else seems to continue on, this seems to be the worst and most isolating aspect, that no one else senses the pain that you have undergone. No one else seems to know. No one else seems to care. No one else seems to see or get the pain we feel. Even when they say they do, we often sense a barrier that they don't really. Suffering makes us feel alone. But this is, I think, the meaning of the tears of Christ, that his soul is sorrowful under death, that the suffering of Christ shows that we are not truly alone. And if it weren't for the tears of Christ, I don't think we would actually know this. Socrates even knows that his soul is immortal. That's quite the thought. But he has no reason to think that any of the gods care a whit about his suffering. If that's the case, it's better to ignore it. Philosophy can tell us many extraordinary truths, but it falls silent before the inevitable experience of suffering. Philosophy can tell you many noble truths, but it cannot tell you that God cares about your suffering. Only God himself can tell you this, and Christ has done so through his suffering. Now, all four of these ways, as a concluding thought, are extremely instructive, I think, not only for your own suffering, but also how you can approach the suffering of others. The best way to console others in their suffering is not to highlight their sins. I do not recommend this. There might be a time for that, but it's rarely in the midst of suffering, even if it may be true that people have brought sometimes people bring their suffering upon themselves. The best way to console others is not to shrug at the inexplicability of suffering. It's a mystery. When your friends suffer, if you have any wisdom, you will become immediately aware of how painfully you do not know what to say. Don't try to come up with something. Suffering shows us how little we know. The best way to console others is also not to point out that good might come from their suffering, that it's actually a blessing in disguise. It's a good thing that this suffering happened to you. For many people, this is hard or impossible to see, even that good could come out of it. The best way to console others in their suffering is simply to be with them. And this is one of the perpetual gifts that Christ offers in his suffering, even in the horror of it, that the sure and tangible knowledge that God himself has not forgotten us in our suffering. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.